Greetings and salutations from the Agile Podcast. This is Tony.
And Craig.
Crickets, and Renee.
The Agile Revolution's here again.
So out of how many revolutioners, how many are sick?
I guess officially I'm sick, yeah.
That makes me as well.
You sound like you've been dragged out of the ocean, Tony.
Yeah, I feel like it too.
Oh dear. So what's happening, guys, in the world of Agile, Renee? You got any cool stuff to share with us?
I have big news. So for those who are listening, and this is going to be really intriguing time-wise because of the delay that sometimes we have between recording versus promoting, but generally us talking together is better. Anyway, for people who do not live in Australia, then we actually have a new Prime Minister via our usual coup, 5 and 5 years. Apparently that's really stable. But anyway, despite this, our new Prime Minister, he's a bit, I guess, edgy compared to our old other person. And inside of his first 24 hours, made several references to Agile. And in the last couple of days, which is, you know, virtually been his whole week of leadership, has made a really intriguing reference to emotional intelligence is probably the most important asset for, he said, a leader, basically.
Yeah,
so what do you guys think about the change?
Yeah, I noticed it.
Well, I was a bit worried about his mentions of Agile. I didn't actually see the actual speech itself, but I saw some transcripts of it, and it's one of those things when you see a CIO, you know, who's just read something on the in-flight magazine and then kind of mentioned Agile 20 times. I felt a little bit like that. I mean, certainly Malcolm Turnbull, who's the Prime Minister we're talking about, has certainly got more tech cred than other politicians, and has been in the role of communications minister for many years. I haven't always necessarily agreed with all the things that he's done in that role, but nonetheless he's still sufficiently knowledgeable about those things. So hopefully when he said the word agile, he had some reference to actually meaning being more nimble and being more efficient rather than just throwing around buzzwords for the sake of it.
Well, I think there's certainly a very strong buzzword element to it. And like a lot of CEOs, as they start off, and even CIOs, there's a lot of buzzwords that come out of them. So, you know, it'd be really interesting and intriguing for me to see over time how much of this comes into fruition in reality. But he's a strong advocate for startups. So it'd be intriguing to see if the space of Australia shifts to have more of those over the next couple of years, but it's potentially a good boon for the Agile community here in Australia.
Potentially. Do you think he's in the market for an Agile coach?
I'm very busy at the moment. How about you?
I don't really want to live in Canberra, to be honest with you.
My trouble.
Point, me neither. So what do you reckon, Tony?
On the NBN, that'd be the problem. And then he wouldn't like what I had to say.
Well, he rolled that out, didn't he? That was one of his jobs.
He rolled it out and screwed it up.
He rolled it out and he screwed it up.
How did he screw it up?
Because he took it from being what it was going to be to the crappy version of, I would call it the NBN, the Clayton's NBN, the NBN you're having when you're not having an NBN.
Are you saying that he did an MVP that was too small?
No. I'm saying what he's put in place is not going to work and is not going to be sustainable.
Can I just be the usual voice of reason that I am on this podcast to anyone who's listening who's not in Australia and goes, what the heck are those acronyms just been throwing around? NBN is the National Broadband Network, which was essentially our answer to get off prehistoric low ADSL
cable
speeds up to something up to something decent, says the guy who's sitting on about 4 megabits a second right now. what are you laughing at, Tony?
I can imagine I'll be about the same. But there'd be my point. But anyway.
I think the good news is that we can be hopeful there's some change. I was very disappointed in some of the things that have been done recently around data retention and around the great firewall debate that we've had in this country, and some of those things are a little disappointing. So I hope maybe that that now he's in the top job, that maybe he'll have some influence on some things, but I guess it all depends on how the new minister in that space fares moving forward.
So are you saying that you felt to date in the role of a communications minister is not living up to your ideal of outcomes?
Yeah, I think there are some problems when someone has a little bit of knowledge. Sometimes that can be very dangerous, and I'm not entirely sure that some of the decisions have been made, NBN, National Broadband Network, that we just talked about, as well as some of the data and firewall things, are necessarily in the best interest of the country.
I fail to see how the data retention one particularly. Anybody who has the naivety to think that once they have the data that they won't be tempted to use it is just living in a dream.
But on the same token,
and for those outside of the country, we're not talking about what happened in America as far as recording people. We're talking about them being able to go into our, is it telcos, and pull out files? Is that right?
Well, they're doing it now. They're dynamically doing it.
They're listening to this podcast as we speak.
But that's
right.
No, you see, they're not listening in on conversations like they were in the States. They're just recording downloads, aren't they? What you're downloading versus uploading and so forth.
And when they see that a million people have downloaded this podcast, we could be in a lot of trouble.
Correct.
He says he wishes.
Anyway.
So I'd like to say hello to our new overlords and welcome them into the...
George Orwell is here and well and alive.
So you've
okay, already, well, I mean...
I was going to say, Renee, you've always sort of had some thoughts about, in the political arena, the way things have been run. What's your view on this?
Look, I like some of the words that's coming out of them. I am concerned, as per any new leader, when they say these sorts of words, it's great that we've got someone who's articulate. He does tend to do a bit of buzzword bingo. He's mentioned disruption an awful lot, and I must agree with the media. I'm a bit over the word disruption at the moment. But look, at least the last guy who was apparently the Minister of Women, not going to get into that too much, but at least he's saying some things that the last guy wasn't even able to say. It's just whether he can follow through on it, I think, is the big debate.
Do you think in general that that politicians, some of the newer politicians coming through, are far more technically savvy? I mean, I think back to Obama.
No, not at all.
But I think back to Obama when he came into power. I mean, for the time that he came in, he did some reasonably radical things. I mean, obviously, he was one of the first ones to embrace social media. He brought in the role of CTO. Obviously, there's some things that didn't go so well. We could talk about Obamacare and some of those things. I sort of worry a little bit because it is such a big thing, and where are they getting some of their information from? Because they are a little more technical savvy than they were before, certainly. But are they savvy enough for the speed and the rate that we need to change?
Well, I think they're still languishing behind commercial organisations, though, as far as the uptake of savviness with technology.
Well, certainly within the government departments, I would absolutely agree with you. Most government departments are still...
archaic.
Yeah, there's a lot of extremely old processes and mismanagement going on. That's a fairly generalisation, but in a lot of cases, they're not as efficiently run as they could be. If they were in business, they'd be out of business.
Agreed. I think I do see some of the new blood coming through. So take a Wyatt Roy, for those who don't know him, he's one of the youngest politicians ever. He's very social media savvy, has a good understanding of the technology. Hopefully they're capable of influencing some of that.
Well, there you go. So welcome to the political revolution with your hosts, Craig, Renee. And
What do you guys reckon about that comment that he made around leadership, though? So emotional intelligence is probably the most important asset.
I must admit I didn't hear that one. In what context was it?
There you go. You're
assuming that I watch the news. If it's not on the project, I don't watch it.
Okay.
For international listeners, that's Australia's
version.
So the
truth is nobody can...
To say for international listeners, the project is Australia's version of The Daily Show or something along those lines.
Yeah. So the truth is nobody can have experienced exactly the same experiences as any other Australians. The important thing is to have the emotional intelligence and the empathy and the imagination that enables you to walk into someone else's shoes, to be able to sit down with them on a train or in a street, to hear their story, to have the imagination to understand how they feel. Emotional intelligence is probably the most important asset certainly for anyone in my line of work.
So I want to know who his speechwriter is. That's the person who's feeding the lines.
Yeah.
Potentially. Yeah, so that's an interview with Lee Sales. 7:30 report on the ABC Monday.
Look, any of those words are good. I think the time will tell whether they're words that are understood or have any meaning.
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially the same as when you're working in organisations. You'll hear the talk, but then whether they can actually do it on the ground is the next thing. So I agree with you, Craig.
Alrighty. Moving on. Craig, what do you got?
What have I got? A few interesting stories that have come across just recently. This one's from about a month or so ago, but the CTO of Etsy moved on, and he sort of parted with a blog called 5 Years Building a Culture and Handing It Off, which I thought was very interesting. He talks about when he joined Etsy, and for those who have been following anything, Etsy's always been one of those poster childs to their development approach, their continuous delivery things, their engineering approaches, and have been very good at blogging about it. And so when the CTO signed off, he just said, look, when I started, this was all kind of really small, and now I'm leaving it in a different state. But when he left, he kind of said, here's just a couple of things that or some theories I had and how they worked out. So his first theory was that nothing we know about software development should be assumed to be true.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially a lot of our practices are remnants when software was written by one person, but modern software is a team sport, which very much falls into the types of things we talk about in Agile. Theory two, technology is the product of the culture that builds it. So great technology is the product of a great culture. Culture is what you do, not what you say. It starts at the top. It affects everything. You have a choice about the culture you promote, not about the culture you have. Theory three, software development should be thought of as a cycle of continual learning and improvement rather than progression from start to finish or a search for correctness. And he goes on to say, if you aren't shipping, you aren't learning. And when he was talking about his role at Etsy, one of the things he really tried to do was see how far he could scale it. Theory four, you build a culture of learning by optimizing globally, not locally. So improvement using shared tools, practices, and belief is more important than individual pockets of brilliance. And theory five, you want to build for the long term, the only guarantee is change. So he talks about investing in your people, your ability to ask questions, and he talks about things like continuous delivery, some of the different ways that we're doing monitoring and testing and debugging, those type of things. So I just sort of look at where Etsy's kind of gone to, and I think, you know what, those were some pretty interesting bets that he took and a few experiments, and I think they all paid off and aligned with the types of things we're thinking about.
I must admit, I mean, I did read that blog and I got very confused by it because he talked about these theories, but it wasn't quite clear to me whether they were proven, whether they worked or didn't work.
I think if you know anything about Etsy, they certainly worked.
It worked, yeah. I think they. I think he was incredibly lucky to put some of those things and get away with them in today's modern environment. But good luck to him.
Yeah, I mean, he says further down that article, these last 5 years testing these theories, making discoveries, growing a team who has changed how software is built. I'm incredibly proud and grateful to be part of it. And I'm proud to be part of growing Etsy from a tiny, not always online website to a billion-dollar public company that challenges conventional notions of whether you can be led by values other than selfishness and be a successful business at the same time. So I think one of the things that you kind of look at here is that a lot of the things they did there was through some, you know, in part by some good leadership, that, you know, he did what, you know, we like to see leaders do, which was get out of the way and actually build an environment in which people could flourish. So he had some ideas and some theories, but ultimately, you know, built an awesome culture. And so the interesting thing will be, if it really is a culture, how well that continues as we move forward.
Yeah. If you change all the leaders, will it continue?
Well, even just by stepping aside as a CTO, you know, how will the company look in a year? If it's really culture, then it will obviously be embedded. And I should believe it should, just I guess being a very much an outside observer.
Well, the only thing that happens with that could change that factor is the person they bring in doesn't believe in the culture, wants to put their own stamp on it. We've seen that happen before.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, see it happen very regularly.
So it'll be interesting if, you know, I wonder if he had a hand in the recruiting. Don't know.
Anyway, it was just an interesting little article. It's always nice when people sort of put their thoughts down before they walk out the door.
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah, I agree.
Very nice.
Tony.
Nexus Scrum Skype.
Is that a new Google phone?
What the heck? A new car, isn't it?
What the heck were they thinking when they named this?
Look, I knew it was going to be
a car, isn't it?
I thought Renee would like to comment on it greatly.
Oh, I didn't even have it up. I've got to bring it up and I've got to find it. I can't find it now.
So
what do we think?
I've got it in front of it, but I just love the blurb that's on the front page, which is about Nexus. So Tony, firstly, before I do that, what is Nexus?
It's a car.
Yeah.
it's a phone.
Okay, so
it's a plane.
Oh yeah, it's a phone. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Nexus is for scaling Scrum. It's Ken Schwaber's new framework, if you like, or it's an, I think to quote him, an abstracted framework for scaling, which we named Nexus, defined as a casual link between things such as biological nervous systems. In our case, a Nexus is a 3 to 9 Scrum teams that are working on a single product backlog to build an integrated increment that meets a goal.
And I love in their website where they talk about Nexus. Nexus is the exoskeleton of scaled Scrum. It drives to the heart of the scaling issue, continually identifying and removing dependencies created by increased complexity. And just to be in the same area as Less less huge, they then say, for larger initiatives, creating product families or interoperating functional units, we create Nexus Plus, unification of more than one Nexus.
Yes. Nexus Plus is more than one Nexus interoperating to build a large product, usually integrated through a product family framework, API, or such. We developed or reformulated new 30-plus practices which cause Nexus to operate predictably.
So this is just Less or... No, safe or
no, Renee. It's Nexus
or Enterprise Scrum.
Sorry. Nexus. TM.
Wait. There's more. Enterprise Portfolio. There's so many of these. Really.
But this is the Scrum one.
Well, you could do a free open assessment on it as well.
Okay, I'm going to start on a positive one here. There is a PDF. It's sort of like the whole Scrum rulebook thing. It's short. Yay.
The Nexus.
It's 10 pages.
The 10-page Nexus guide, the definitive guide to Nexus.
Version 1.1 I'm referring to here. So that's good. It's not really a nice, pretty diagram I can click through on. I really like that diagram.
I think
it's in the same format as the Scrum guide, so if you like reading that, it's the same.
It's got a couple of interesting things. There's also a free and open assessment you can do as a test of the likelihood of your success in scaling.
Because there's enough evidence out there about what works and what doesn't work, right?
Yeah, well,
Sorry, sarcasm came out. I noticed they changed practices or even cadences to events. Yeah, that's an interesting language change.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting naming. I'm not sure how I feel about that. Because
you know what I like? Nexus events. That sounds so cool. It's like we're in a sci-fi movie now. Oh, wait, it's sort of like scrums, you know, like I'm in a game where I'm playing with other players. I'm in Nexus events.
I don't know.
See, I knew when I brought this up, this happened, by the way.
And exoskeletons. It all sounds so sci-fi, doesn't it? This is like the Star Trek of Agile.
Mm. And it also says
In fact, the picture of Ken Schwaber on the front, mate, looks a little bit like Captain Picard, really.
Picard, yeah.
Make it so.
Interestingly, in his blurb, he says, those of you who have invested and attempted commercial scaling methodologies such as SAFe will find this workshop may well fill the gap that you notice when you got to actually setting up and running scaled software development. So I'm interested to understand what the gap is.
Me too. Because I haven't, I've just done my own thing and it just worked, but okay. So what is it? What's the heart of the framework? Run us through it, Tony.
Well, yeah, let's run through the diagram because a lot of the things are the same. So it's based on the fact that the backlogs are all shared. That's probably something that's a little bit different to some of the other, not all of them, but some of the other frameworks.
No. I think they are all shared in the other ones.
Yeah, not necessarily. Some of the other frameworks, the different teams have their own. If you look at SAFe, for example, you have your own product backlog or your own sprint backlog. You have a shared product backlog.
Yeah, it's rather interesting, isn't it?
So all those things are shared, right? The product backlog, the sprint planning, and the sprint backlog.
Okay, I didn't read it that way, but okay.
And you have your Nexus sprint planning, so that hasn't really changed.
The difference is that you then have in your sprint cycle 3 to 9 Scrum teams. Working on different parts of the solution. And it doesn't really give any guidance as to how those...
how big are they?
Well, how big they are or indeed how those teams should be split up.
Yeah, it doesn't really, does it?
So if we've got, for example, 9 teams and... Let's think positively that there were 7 people in those 9 teams. We're talking about 63 people in a room during sprint planning, 63 people in a room doing a retrospective. Is that right?
No. So the sprint backlog, so the product backlog is shared by the teams. The sprint backlog, you then have each individual team has, is my understanding.
Yeah, but in the step before, it's got Nexus Sprint Plan. Can we read Nexus Sprint Planning? What does it say?
You're saying that might be helpful to actually read the guide before we talk about it?
yeah, okay. I really like that. Sprint Planning, the purpose is to coordinate the activities of all the teams in the Nexus for a single sprint. Appropriate representatives from each Scrum team validate and make adjustments to the ordering of the work.
Yeah, and what's not clear to me is how many people are in that sprint planning. I'm not sure what it says further down here, but I'm sure it's somewhere.
Appropriate representatives.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah, well, that leaves it open to... You have to do the workshop to get certified.
Probably. At least you don't have to pay yet, Tony. True.
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 True. Yet. Yes.
And then you've got this new team called the Nexus Integration Team, which consists of a product owner, a scrum master, and one or more Nexus Integration Team members.
Hmm. Interesting.
And those team members may also work on the scrum teams in that Nexus, but priority must be given to the work of the Nexus Integration Team. So it's like a...
What?
So the Nexus Integration Team are there to make sure that all the teams, that their work integrates. But if they run out of things to do in that team, they then fall back to one of the other teams. But their precedence should always be to the Nexus Integration Team, not the other teams.
Okay.
So they're like,
and how's integration defined in this context?
So they're a little bit like a scrum master in that they're more of a floating team member. That if they become available, they roll their sleeves up and help the team.
But I guess I'm having troubles with the word integration here. Are we talking about, you know, literally integrating code and applying feature toggling, or?
It could be any of the things you need to do to integrate the, to integrate.
Why wouldn't teams be doing that as they're building?
Well, what it's saying here is, I'm just reading whilst we were conversing. It says, one thing I know is we need to build the tools and integration tools, the application lifecycle management tools. That's a pretty stiff learning curve for most organizations. So he's talking about this particular team. These people are there to help them set up and use it. Jira, Jenkins, Git, Foundation, all the things you need to be successful with large projects for the multiple teams. So by inference, what I read here is this team is responsible for helping these teams to build this stuff together.
Yeah, it says further down, the Nexus Integration Team consists of software professionals who are skilled in the use of these practices, tools, and the general field of systems engineering. Nexus Integration Team members ensure that the practices and tools are implemented, understood, and used to detect dependencies and frequently integrate all artifacts to a definition of done. If their primary responsibility is satisfied, Nexus Integration Team members may also work as development team members in one or more Scrum teams.
Yeah. Interesting.
It's weird. It almost sounds like we moved like Sprint Zero stuff off to this integration team.
I think in some ways it addresses the problem that a lot of teams have anyway, which is when you've got something reasonably large, as people and DevOps certainly picks up a little bit of it, where how do you kind of put all this stuff together? So it brings in a little bit of DevOps. It's not an answer to DevOps, because in true DevOps, those people should really be part of the Scrum teams. But it does make sure that, you know, if you have, in the case of their diagram, 3 to 9 Scrum teams, that all of the tooling and release and all those type of things is shared between them. If you follow the Scrum guide and you just have one Scrum team, that one Scrum team takes care of it itself. So it's essentially abstracting that out. But the thing it says all the way through here is, all the way through the book, is kind of says that your mileage will vary, and there's some wording it uses in here somewhere I'll have to go find, but essentially it'll depend on your situation, and they say this quite a bit throughout the guide.
It's not a very good guide then.
Well, it's only 10 pages. It's not very much in depth. I'm sure there's a book coming.
I'm sure the training will cover it.
Well, of course, you can go and do a scaled professional Scrum course.
Mm. How much does that cost?
Oh, I don't know, but there's multiple courses. You can do scaled professional Scrum. And there's a number of SPS trainers that will help you with that. That then gets you a scaled, you can do the scaled professional scrum assessment, the SPS, to get an industry recognized SPS certification. Why scrum?
And I'd want that. Why?
Why would you want that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think you just want it for adornment, Renee.
It's an industry recognized SPS certification. You require a minimum passing score on this rigorous assessment, and you can be on the scrum.org public list of SPS certificate holders. Oh, I can't see what's not to like, Renee.
Trying really hard not to laugh.
And let's face it, there's one thing Renee needs, it's certification.
And at the date of recording, there are 37 people in the world who have this certification.
37?
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Is there anyone we know?
Probably. I'd say there would be.
Yeah, look through the list, nobody's name that... But if you have an SPS certification, drop us a line at the Agile Revolution. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'd love to hear. We're always happy to hear. We've talked to the SAFe people. Let's talk to the SPS people.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, let's look at the positives and minuses. The minus to me is that it's yet another scaled approach. And I've got a story coming in a moment that I'm still not sold on this whole scaling thing. But... The benefit to me is that it wraps very nicely around Scrum, probably more nicely even than what Less does, and Less is a pretty lightweight framework in its own right. So those two approaches wrap around there. What I would love to know, and you know, if I had the ear of either Ken or Craig or Ed Al from Less, is what did Les have nor not have that prompted Schwaber to do Nexus or vice versa? And is it just a they wanted to be in control money, of the framework? Well, money or control. Was that really the driving factor? Because to me, the basis of them, that they both wrap around Scrum very, very closely is both the positive and the negative. Whereas you take something like the Scaled Agile Framework, which obviously has an element of Scrum, but a lot of its positives and minuses are outside the inside the wider framework itself.
That was very good, Craig. A nice synopsis.
It is interesting. It's worth a read of the guide. Have a bit of a look of it, but the guy left me with more questions than answers,
which is meant to be.
Yeah, I mean,
more so than the Scrum.
I guess in my experience of working, in an environment where there are a number of teams working on the same product, and we implemented our own version of Scaled Agile. Knowing the difficulties that we hit and knowing the solutions that we got to resolve those problems, this is nowhere near cutting it. Nowhere near. Anyway.
And so what things are missing in your opinion?
So things like risk and issue management across this many teams.
Oh, but you don't need need a project manager in Scrum, Renee.
I didn't say you needed a project manager. I just said that you needed to have risk and issue management. And it does talk about refinement, I guess. So that's a good thing. And there's many different ways you could do that. I would suspect if I read this in more detail and chance that it probably wouldn't cut it from a portfolio management perspective and even like a portfolio Kanban perspective, which, in fairness, Less does a little bit of, but still, I don't think anyone's doing an awfully smack on job on portfolio Kanban, to be honest.
So, is the issue if you extend it though, that then you end up with SAFe? Because you've got this to me that feels at the very lightweight end, and then you've got Less, which is got a little more meat around the edges, but leaves a lot of things open. And then you go all the way up the other end to the Scaled Agile framework and Disciplined Agile Delivery, which have lots of moving parts to them. I'm not sure how we get a happy medium here.
And I think that's probably more the point that for teams that need to apply Agile in a scaled environment, I wouldn't say pick a single framework. I'd be encouraging understanding of the different types of frameworks that are out there and understanding why certain things work and why things don't, and understanding your constraints that you have in the area that you're in and the problems that you're hitting, and applying process in a very rational way to address those problems.
Tony?
Yeah, I agree. I agree completely. I mean, in my experience, not one size is going to... Pieces of the puzzle, depending where you're at. So, again, it's about... I guess it's the same thing we talk about a lot, but it's the toolkit, right? It's having that toolkit, knowing what tools or trying the tools that work. The minute you lock it down... And I guess that's what I've always had to say about SAFe. Like, again, for me, you lock it down to one method, one framework, then I think you're limiting yourself, and you don't, again, you end up with gaps, you end up with things that don't work, and then things fail. So it comes back to the oath of non-allegiance, which, again, to me, says it all. You've got to take the best of what works, work it out, and use it. Don't be afraid to use the different tools.
And I'm interested to read, there's a new book that's just been released by Sanjeev Augustine called Scaling Agile, Lean Jumpstart. And one of the things that book has is an overview of all the different scaling techniques and frameworks in it. So the Scrum of Scrums, the Lean Agile PMO, Spotify, Scaled Agile Framework, Less, DAD, and Nexus. And I haven't got around to reading that book yet, but I have it here. Interested to see what that book has to say. That book was written very much as a guide for managers and decision makers who are trying to work their way through this whole myriad of which one of these things do I choose.
Yeah. I mean, I guess as someone who coaches teams and works in that type of that environment, you have a predilection to particular methods, which for me, Scrum of Scrums, Portfolio Kanban, but then I'm not afraid to say, well, that's not going to work in this situation and you need to add in extras. So, again, I go back to that. You've got to use the right horse for the right course.
And I don't think anyone would disagree with you there, Tony.
I'm sure there are people that do, right?
I don't know. They need an agile horse, scaled horse framework.
A horse framework, a scaled horse framework. There we go.
Are you saying you roll in a big wooden horse and jump out and go surprise with like three developers and a tester?
How do you determine whether you need a pedigree horse or a donkey or an ass?
Oops. Or a mule.
Anyway.
Someone had to go too far, didn't they?
Moving swiftly on, the flip side of this was an interesting article that I read on firstround.com, which is the story behind the service Pocket. Do you guys use Pocket?
Yeah.
So Pocket's one of these save it later services, you know, the ones you can read stuff offline. I quite like it. It's good for bookmarking things. But this article is about how Pocket hit 20 million users with just 20 people. So it's an interview with the founder of Pocket, Nate Wiener. And Pocket's been going for 4 or 5 years now. And the fact that he actually kept the organization extremely small, basically just him and one other person for a long, long time, and resisted the urge to scale. So he's in this article, he talks about that having a smaller headcount actually forced the focus of the company. That, you know, there was, for example, they had lots of different projects on their backlog, but they had far more projects and employees, so therefore they had to actually make decisions over which things were actually going to attack the bottom line. He asked the question in there, if you're leading a small company or a team, ask yourself the question, restrictions aside, would I put the entire company behind this project? And if the answer is yes, then find a way to do it.
I like that question.
And so he kind of says in here that, you know, if you're over 100 employees, you know, still find a way to manufacture the same scenario, right? Think back to a time when your company could fit into one room and ask yourself if you'd put everyone on the project if you could. And if the answer is yes, consider deploying more reinforcements from your current team. Right? Even at 20, 30, or even 50 people, you should really just be focused on the one thing that needs to happen right now. In other words, right, limit WIP. He talks about that he suggests putting the full team on the most critical project every quarter. Over the next 90 days, what's going to be the project that makes the difference? Let's just make sure that we hit that goal the best we can, then move on to the next project. And he said now they're actually shortening their project one runway to under 30 days, especially for engineering sprints.
I like it.
And so he talks a lot about his culture, and he sort of said, look, he really, because he, essentially the culture being a small startup was essentially built around him because he was the founder of it. The hardest thing for him was actually then to decide when he needed to start to expanding. So, you know, the first thing he really realized was he didn't have design skills. So, you know, he had to bring in someone to do that. But he said one of the things he looked at whenever he hired someone was to bring on people who that value the idea or the product as much as he did, but people who could make it better than he could have ever done it.
So people who are passionate about the product already.
Yeah, or making something better.
Yeah, and I think that's the value of being able to keep it small too is that he can handpick those, because once it starts to get too big and too scaled, then he loses sight and control of that type of person that he's bringing into the organization. Even though he may set the standard and say to people, this is the type of person I want, it's that personal, being able to have the personal touch to it that he knows who he's recruiting. That makes a big difference.
I wonder how long it took him to hire that first person.
Let's see.
Can after I... the two.
First person. Scrolling out, it's a fairly long article. It was a couple of years in, I think, from memory. It was very small for a long time. But that first person was really when he decided that he didn't have... So as with all startups, at some point you realize you can't do it all to completion or to a high standard. For example, I really need help with design. So Nikki, our head of design, was our first hire. I had the engineering product experience, but she brought the design chops we need to make a truly great product. Doesn't actually say when that was, though. Maybe it's just further down the article somewhere. He also talks about, he says that a small startup can use its size to force focus and better preserve culture as it grows, but these benefits are just the fuel for the work the team has to do. Its output, the actual product, can also scale without increasing headcount, but only through two channels. The only way a product can grow from a team of our size is if your platform carries you or your users carry you.
Yeah.
And so part of it was making sure that there was a product that had a platform behind it. And so the real success to Pocket was the fact that it was, and as he says in here, without a sales or marketing team, Pocket made its app as simple and straightforward for other companies to learn about and integrate, which is in turn has exponentially grown the Pocket's users. To date, the company has tallied 2,000 integrations, among them Firefox, Twitter, Flipboard, and Kobo.
Wow.
As a small, growing, fast company, you can grow on a hiring. You can go on a hiring spree or lean on your platform. And so he decided to do the latter.
Yeah, quite rightly so. I think a very smart move. I mean, it's a great little app, as you know. What I like about it is it's simple.
And so this is one of the things he talked about. Is one of the reasons that they grew, that they were able to grow, was that they actually made their platform extremely simple. So their API made it very easy for people who wanted to integrate the platform to just go do it. They didn't have to go and fill out lots of forms. It was all sort of easily available. And so their early deals were with Kobo and Firefox. And he said the deals with them only happened because we made it easy for them to self-serve. At first, Kobo asked us to integrate Pocket in 2 months. He said if our team of a dozen people had to build it from scratch, it would have never have happened. But we said, here's our API, and they were able to integrate it within 14 days.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, and then he says, you woo big partners tenaciously with your platform, but then keep them with transparency.
I think it's a great story. And I think a lot of those principles in the we do well in a lot of organisations to be able to adopt. I think they lose sight of that passion.
I think the more interesting story in there, though, is the they made the right priority calls very early on. It seems that way anyway. And I wonder how they did that.
Well, I think it was because they stuck true to the problem they were trying to solve. Because, I mean, they certainly weren't the first, read it later type app out there. What they did is they got some people who kind of cared about the service, and then got them essentially to ask to ask other companies to put it inside there because they couldn't live without it in other apps. He actually says near the start of the article when he's talking about the size, he says, nearly 4 years into pocket, he decided to raise money to turn his one-man show into a team. So it was actually 4 years until his first hire. I knew I'd read it somewhere. He said, how many people would he need? For someone who built the first version of Pocket on his own in a night, five people seemed like a lot. I asked myself, what the hell would five people do? Evernote, which made a bid to buy Pocket in the early days, employed around 60 people when I first started talking to them. I couldn't fathom having a team that size. What would they work on? Why is a team of 10 working on what one person can do?
Mm.
So there is a little bit of founder mentality in here that obviously you kind of get in and get your hands dirty. But I just like this article because we go on about scaling and we have to throw more and more people at it. But what I like about this is the simplicity of it and the fact that with a small team they're focused on not only building great product but making things easy for other people to integrate to, and as other people integrate to it, that in turn then makes the service a lot
more valuable.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes we get hung up on just having to, it's the old adage of just throwing more people at the problem.
Yeah, completely agree.
Yeah, no disagreement with me either.
So, good little article if you get the chance to read it.
Yeah.
So I've started looking at some articles in a website called searchcio.com. It has some blogs. Unfortunately, you've got to actually log in and register and so forth to get access to some of the content that's available on the site. But the reason why I was having a look was sort of intriguing to me what a blog site dedicated towards the C-suite would sort of look like and what information they're giving out and people are focusing on. So one of the things that sort of looked at that I thought was intriguing was this comment around how to succeed in your first period of time as a new CIO in a job. So I haven't really given you the whole context here, but because I'm going to ask some questions. So
okay, I can just see it's one of those link bait things. It's like, got a new job as a CIO, right? Need to fill the staff? Here, learn five tips how.
Yeah, it is. It's exactly one of those. In fact, it's three, not five. So it's going to be easier for you then. But just in your opinion, what do you think is the amount of time that a CIO has to succeed in? To move the dial or the needle?
12 months.
Okay, Craig?
I think when a new CIO takes over, and this is anybody in a C-level capacity, the troops are waiting for something to come, and your first, probably 15 to 30 days are actually sometimes your most defining moments. Of doing that. And I think about great leaders I've worked for, and I think of about crappy leaders I've worked for, and the great ones are the ones who came out with a vision. So I think you have about 12 months to show that you're making progress on that. But I actually think in your first 15 to 30 days, if people don't hear from you or you're not doing anything different, then there will be it's very hard to then get people on board to your vision or the things that you're aiming to achieve in your tenure there.
Okay, so one of those things that you're talking about in your first 12 months and certainly in your first 30 days is that you want to have a vision. So to give you the answer that's in this article, so I'm not saying it's necessarily the answer, it's saying that nowadays CIOs have between 90 to 120 days to make their mark. So in between a little bit the two. And ultimately it's such a short period of time because you need to be able to, as you said, Craig, you know, define an action plan and start to make the changes to make sure you're on the right track. Otherwise people go, what value are you providing back to the business?
If you think about what we talk about in Agile, so if you take those numbers, all right, 90 days is a release horizon. Right, that's 3 months. In the same time that if you can't ship product in that time, then you're a little bit irrelevant. And if I think back, and I didn't really think about this when I gave my answer, but 15 days is, you know, a couple of sprints, you know, in time. So you've got a iteration zero to get your feet under the table, and then, you know, you essentially need to throw something out there for feedback.
So aside from the 90 to 120 days, what do you think the top three things they should be focusing on in that period of time is?
Go, Tony.
I'm thinking budget.
I think some sort of making sure that there's continuation of service.
Yeah, and I'd hazard a guess at vision or vision statement or strategy statement, one of those things.
Anything else, Craig?
So I think the keeping the lights on, making sure that that anything that's previously in place is not suffering as a result of that. You can make decisions about that later. I agree with Tony that there's some sort of visionary type statement that's needed. Maybe this falls into vision, but part of it is if you, depending on the size of the organization you're taking on, the most important thing when you come in there, in my opinion, is really getting the buy-in from the management team or the people that you have reporting to you.
Okay, all right, so pretty close, two from three. So number one thing that a new CIO must accomplish within the first 3 months is to gather facts on the current IT performance and the perception of IT so that they have a baseline of that performance so that they can actually build an actionable plan from that. So a little bit different from, you know, make a benchmark in the actual operational performance, but understanding the as-is state is effectively what number one is. Number two, this is the one that both of you missed, and I'm really surprised both of you missed. It's talking to the customer and to the business and building effective business relationships.
Yeah, we just took that as a given, you know. It was, of course,
it's a no-brainer. Of course you're going to be building some relationships. So not just relationships inside of IT, it's obviously beyond IT, and then starting to use those relationships to demonstrate the value add that IT has outside of IT, such as innovation and partnership that it could have. So it talks about collaborating at an operational and a strategic level at that point in time. Then number three, which you have talked about, which is that long-term planning perspective. So interestingly, whilst we've talked a lot about short-term and Agile does talk about making sure that you've got outcomes at the end of each iteration, what I really do appreciate in this article is saying there is a longer-term plan in there as well.
Very good. So why are you reading through CIO articles? Is it some sort of a future game plan that you haven't told us about, Renee?
Maybe. Future game plan. Yep. Well, no, it's just I'm also slightly intrigued just to see what are they learning and what are they potentially hearing as well. Like there's another article in here around supportive leadership. Now, you know, to me, supportive leadership is a buzzword I've heard a lot of in the last 6 months. It's just servant leadership renamed. Really?
Yeah, really? I'm seeing that quite a bit. The other one I've just come across in the last 48 hours is something called Fast IT. You heard about this one?
No.
No?
So sounds fast, though. We should do that.
So Fast IT is just the disruption that's coming from all the new technologies, so cloud, Internet of Things, those type of things, and the fact that as an IT
department... Oh, it's a new word for disruption, but we're over it.
Pretty much. Got it. So, yeah, we have to find new buzzwords for these things so that we can write more articles.
Mm.
Okay.
Hey Tony, you still there? You got anything?
No, I'm mulling over the last comment. I'm just a bit
fast IT.
Fast IT.
There you go. Go look it up. It's a thing.
Yeah, I'm thinking we should call it Raccoon.
Oh well, I mean, I've got Jeff Patton on board with that, so hey, anything's possible. Hey, what are you guys reading at the moment? Anything on the book list?
I have been reading a lot lately. Gee, I have to remember which ones I've been reading though. So still reading Reinventing Organizations a little bit every now and then. Transforming via open space, so partway through reading that. And reading
Transforming through Open Space. What's that about? I haven't heard that book.
I'd have to move away from my computer to find the real name of it. So we'll do a link in the show notes, but in essence it's about doing an agile transformation through the concept of an open space.
Interesting.
Yes.
I'm intrigued. I look forward to reading your show notes.
I have, and I'm just looking over my books over here, I have just recently read Start With Why, and I'm halfway through the TED Talk book at the moment.
How is that?
It's pretty good. It's nothing earth-shattering, and really, as I have been reading it, I should have been watching the videos because I think that would be a lot more helpful, but I haven't done that, so...
There you go. Some good reads. Tony?
Yeah, I've been reading David Marquette's Turn the Boat Around.
Turn the boat around. Turn the canoe around.
Ship around. Turn the canoe around. Yes, in between being ill, of course. So.
Santa Fe. Turn it around.
Santa Fe. Yes. The actual, what is it called? The absolute Enron of the fleet. I've even got the lingo down. There you go.
Well, I've actually been back.
Sorry?
You go.
It's a good read. It actually is. It is a good read, and there's some good things in there. I mean, I wouldn't take everything in there. And having spoken with David myself, and as you have, I was impressed with his approach to things. So I actually think it's a good read. It wouldn't hurt a lot of leaders to actually bother to read it.
Agreed.
And I've been back rereading The Phoenix Project again, sort of been getting a little more into some DevOps type things, and it's been a little while since I read it. I read it very quickly. It was one of those things I kind of read on a plane and probably read a little too fast, so I actually slowed down and had a better read of it and stopped to smell the roses a little bit as I went through that book, as much as it's still a novel.
Did you get anything more out of it the second time through? Because it was in a similar position. I read it in about 2 days, which... But I guess there's a good indication that it is an easy read and it's a fun read anyway.
Yeah, I'm about so it was actually one of those things. The reason I actually had to start reading is I was spending a lot of time in emergency rooms, and it was the book I had. So I went, well, I'll have another crack at this, and it was one that I could read while I was where I was a little more tired, sort of one I could concentrate on as opposed to facts. But yes, I actually got a lot more out of it the second time around. When I read it very early on, and perhaps now that I just know more about some of the DevOps concepts, just going back, it's just solidified a few things that that were important there that perhaps I'd forgotten about, and re-solidified a lot of the stuff that it relates right back to things like the goal and those type of things as well. That I knew, but I think I just perhaps missed how close some of those linkages were.
And did you find in your second reading of it that lean, I think they called it a lean coach, I can't even remember what the term they used for it, Sensei in there. Did you find them just as equally annoying the second time around?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the guy's annoying. It was all heck.
Okay.
But hey. I think that was written like that purposely, because it's a bit of a shock and awe tactic in the book to get people thinking.
Yeah, I just found it very smarmy.
Yeah, maybe. I think it was done intentionally. There you go. Have you read the book, Tony?
No, I haven't. That's why I was listening intently. That is something I haven't got around to, but I have just added it to my, as you were speaking, it has been added to my reading list right now.
Excellent.
There we go.
Well, I think we might be done.
Yes. Is there anything out in Twitter land that's caught anybody's interest, or are we out?
I haven't seen too many, just commentable comments lately.
I had one a very long time ago, but I'd have to look it up, so if that's useless to us right now.
So I think it goes notable that this is our, if I'm not wrong, would I be right? This would be our 99th episode.
99 not out, Tony.
So this is our Don Bradman.
That's the one.
I want to take this opportunity to congratulate this Agile Life on beating us to 100. Shock.
No, I don't want to congratulate them. No.
Yeah. Okay, I will, but anyway.
I think it's more based on quality rather than quantity myself, Renee.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, quality versus quantity. I mean,
how long you've got staying power for, it's...
And, you know, if you look through our podcasts, our mix of subtle innuendo has always contributed to the quality of the commentary.
Or lack of.
so should we do something special to celebrate 100 episodes then?
I think we should.
Like meet up in person?
No, that'd never work.
That'd never work. Nice. We could pop a champagne cork or two.
Something
like that. What were you thinking?
What were you thinking, Craig?
I don't know. I just think getting to 100 episodes is one of those things. I didn't think we were going to get past one episode in the beginning.
I think there was a lot of people that thought that, actually.
So, yeah, I think we should think about it. If you got a call out that if anybody's got any favorite memories or things that that just have happened in Agile in general since the revolution started back in, what was it, 2011? You know, drop us a line. We'll do something, I think, for the 100th episode. We should record something. So, we'll get a thinking caps
we
on
right after. Yeah, we should do a podcast.
That would be a great. Yeah, we should record the conversation. Record the party. That's a great idea, Renee.
Yeah, it's almost as good as my idea about actually getting together for the podcast.
Yeah, you sound a bit sore there, Renee.
I think Renee.
Maybe I took the effort of going onto a plane to do the 100th episode and for it to be cancelled on the day of. Hey, listen,
two people showed up.
True. Two did.
You notice that one of us is very silent in the background. What they're referring to is the fact that I have been very ill, but I take the jobs happily. So.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, wraps up the 100 episodes. Right? Tony's very ill, Renee's very annoyed, and Craig's just here.
Oh, heavens. So with our 100th episode, I would imagine we'd have to have some excerpts from the original one just to see if we've evolved.
Oh, dear. That first one was Craig's one, wasn't it, on Salt Lake City?
No, the first one was the first one was a wrap-up from Agile Australia, from memory.
Yeah, it's what I thought, yeah.
So
maybe not the first one.
let's play the first good one.
Okay, so we'll have to go to episode 100.
that would be the one. Ah, well.
Walked into that one, didn't we?
We did.
All right, we'll have a look through the vaults and take a look back. It's been a bit of a journey.
Yes. All right. Well, I guess as we have done for 98 times, 99 times, there's only one thing left to say.
What?
Yeah, guys, come on now. After all this time, surely we can get our act.
Okay, well, if you want to contact us, you can contact us on at Renee@theagilerevolution.com.
Tony at theagilerevolution.com.
Or Craig at the recently said address, theagilerevolution.com.
Oh, and after 99 episodes, you think we could have got that right. Okay, and what do we need to say? All right, I'll do it for you. Viva.
La. Revolution, get out of here.
Revolution, we gave you one job to do, Renee. Just one job.
After 99 episodes, you'd think she'd get it right.
Heavens above. Oh, well, you know what they say. Never work with kids. Or animals.
Or an ape.
The revolution.
You'll edit that out, right, Craig?
Hell no.